Hey, it's Andrew, the Director of Literary Arts. Like many organizations, Literary Arts is working hard to continue serving our community in this unprecedented time. And we hope you're able to help us continue our mission. We're providing free online youth writing classes, virtual events and classes for adult readers and writers, ongoing resources for writers including an emergency fund, and planning on live author presentations as soon as it is safe. We are looking forward to the future, but we need your support today. Please make a donation now at literary-arts.org to ensure we can continue to offer timely resources to our community. Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Haan. Cole Haan's shoes, bags, and outerwear go with you while you work your way to extraordinary. More at colehaan.com. In this episode, we feature poet Evan Boland from 2008. Born in Dublin in 1944, Evan Boland divided her childhood between London and New York, later returning to Dublin to attend Trinity College. She published her first collection of poems, titled New Territory, at age 22 in 1966. She went on to publish 6 volumes of poetry in her life and 2 books of prose, and won countless prizes in a career that spanned 5 decades. Boland matters not only because of her craft and artistry, but because of what her work brought to Irish poetry and the art form in general. The experiences of women and their contributions to culture and history. These were recurring topics of Boland's work. In an interview, Boland explained, quote, "I began to write in an Ireland where the word woman and the word poet seemed to be in some sort of magnetic opposition to each other. I wanted to put the life I lived into the poems I wrote, and the life I lived was a woman's life, and I couldn't accept the possibility that the life of the woman would not or could not be named in the poetry of my own nation." Evan Boland died of a stroke at the age of 75 on April 27, 2020, at her home in Dublin, Ireland. Her final collection of poems, The Historians, will be published by Norton in October. Here's Boland.
Just going to really read some work and speak about the things that, when you look back on poetry and when you, over the last couple of years I put together a new collected, and, when you look back and you try to think of the things that influenced you, they're not always the things that you thought at the start. I'm going to read a very brief piece of prose from a book I wrote called Object Lessons, which, leads into the thing that most influenced me. In the early days of October, in the year 1909, a woman entered a Dublin hospital near the center of the city. The building is still there. If you approach from the south with the Dublin hills behind you and you look down a tunnel of grace made by the houses of Fitzwilliam and Marion Squares, your view will end abruptly in this. The National Maternity Hospital, red brick and out of character, blocking the vista. The rooms inside are functional and light eating, and they show no evidence of that zest for air and proportion which was once the mask of an Augustan oppressor. October is a beautiful month in the city of Dublin, and if you turn round and go back towards the hills away from the hospital, the roads are narrow and gracious above the canal. The woman who entered the hospital might have passed them as she made her way to it. If, for instance, she drove around Stephen's Green, having arrived on the late morning train from Drogheda, she might also have noticed a trick of light peculiar to that time of year. In the dark corridor of Lower Leeson Street, sunlight cuts the houses in half. Halfway up the brick, the reflection of the houses opposite builds another street, chimneys and roofs and gutters made of unglittering shadow. She might not have come that way. She might have traveled down the unglamorous back streets that lead more directly to the hospital. Finian Street and Hogan Place, past the mills, past the Dodder River on its way to the Liffey, up the slight gradient, which would still in that year be cobbled. The pre-winter chill, which can be felt on some October mornings, could have struck extra music out of the horse's hooves. It isn't a long drive, but whatever she saw that morning is lost. Whatever that journey yielded, the child with a hoop who never existed, the woman with a red hat I am now inventing, they were her last glimpses of the outside world. And this is the way we make the past, and this is the way I will make it here. Listening for hooves, glimpsing the red hat, which was never there in the first place, giving eyesight and evidence to a woman I never knew and cannot now recover. And for all our violations, the past waits for us. The road from the train to the hospital opens out over and over again, vacant and glittering, offering shadows and hats and hoops. And again I visit it and reinvent it. But the woman who actually traveled it had no such freedom. Hers was a real journey, and she never came back. On October the 10th, 1909, she died in the National Maternity Hospital in Dublin. She was 31 years of age, and she was my grandmother. The reason I chose that piece of prose was because of all the things that influenced me as a young poet. It was the growing realization in my mind of the difference between the past and history. I grew up at a time in Ireland when Irish history was made. I mean, in many ways, Irish history was, even by then, a story of heroes. You know, the Irish had succeeded against a colonial neighbor. They had made the state. They had succeeded in arms. And in many ways, that narrative was the story of a small country against a great one, and was a story of heroes. But the past is a different place from history, and the past, you know, consists of these shadows and whispers and lost names and no heroes. And increasingly, it was the past that seemed to me the place where I would turn. And yet, you know, I could not understand, and I didn't know why the past and history were so wide apart in that country. I wrote a poem at that time, which was really part of that argument with myself. It's called "That the Science of Cartography is Limited," and it's about the fact that in 1847, when the potato crop had failed twice in Ireland, and what the worst year was 1847, the relief committees came over from England. This terrible laissez-faire economics, and they were meant to give the people food, but they wouldn't give them food unless they could work for it, and of course the people had no strength to work. And they gave out, they parceled out these programs, which were programs of work. One of them was road building, and this was after really a year of hunger and fever. And if you go into the woods, especially in Meath or Mayo, you can look down and see these small roads that give out nowhere, where the people who built them died building them. And yet those roads, which are really the scar tissue of Irish history, don't show up on any map. And this poem was to question that. That the science of cartography is limited, and not simply by the fact that this shading of forest cannot show the fragrance of balsam, the gloom of cypresses, is what I wish to prove. When you and I were first in love, we drove to the borders of Connacht and entered a wood there. Look down, you said, this was once a famine road. I looked down at ivy and the scutch grass rough cast stone had disappeared into, as you told me in the second winter of their ordeal, in 1847, when the crop had failed twice, relief committees gave the starving Irish such roads to build. Where they died, there the road ended and ends still. And when I take down the map of this island, it is never so. I can say here is the masterful, the apt rendering of the spherical as flat, nor an ingenious design which persuades a curve into a plane, but to tell myself again that the line which says woodland and cries hunger and gives out among sweet pine and cypress and finds no horizon will not be there. And the poem which, you know, followed it much later as a poem called Quarantine. It's still the same argument and still maybe an argument now, not just with myself and not just with the history of Ireland, but also with poetry, with those things that are included in the official histories of art and nations and those things that get left out. This poem references a very few sentences which happened in a book which was once very widely read in Ireland, but not now. At the turn of the century, the 20th century, in 1900, a book was written called Muiscéal Féin, which means my story, written by an old man then who was a parish priest looking back to a tiny village in West Cork where the famine had been bad when he was a young boy. And he remembered a story of that village, just a few sentences, of a young couple who, in that year of the famine, on a very bitter winter night, left the workhouse, which was, you know, one of these terrible cauldrons, both of fever and hunger, left the workhouse, and they walked back to the cabin where, you know, they had had what life they'd had. And they were found dead in the morning, but her feet were held against his chest. He had tried to warm them as she died. For these couple of sentences, you know, these people, whoever they were, without name, without history, without anything, gleam into that account and are gone. And I wanted to write the poem really to reproach the forms we have and the histories we have and love poetry, which so rarely recognizes that sort of immense defeat and immense steadfastness, Quarantine. In the worst hour of the worst season of the worst year of a whole people, a man set out from the workhouse with his wife. He was walking, they were both walking north. She was sick with famine fever and could not keep up. He lifted her and put her on his back. He walked like that, west and north, until at nightfall, under freezing stars, they arrived. In the morning, they were both found dead of cold, of hunger, of the toxins of a whole history. But her feet were held against his breastbone. The last heat of his flesh was his last gift to her. Let no love poem ever come to this threshold. There is no place here for the inexact praise of the easy graces and sensuality of the body. There is only time for this merciless inventory. Their death together in the winter of 1847. Also, what they suffered, how they lived, and what there is between a man and woman and in which darkness it can best be proved. And I followed that theme of memory into a more personal story in an earlier thing, but it was still, for me, the attempt to find out that place, that shadow place between history and the past, how much of our own lives we consider enough importance to put into the story. Many, many years ago, my husband Kevin and I went to the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa. And we took two very small children with us, both under the age of three. One of those children really became deathly ill in that city. And we truly thought she would die. She was a little girl of 11 months. She had meningitis. She made a wonderful recovery there. And she owes a great deal to the hospital and to the doctors there. But, you know, I went back years later to read for the workshop, the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and I went back to the bridge where Kevin and I had met one really snowy day when we really did not know whether this child would live or die. And, you know, it was winter and, you know, it was years ahead, but I could see Kevin in front of me as clearly as if he had been there. And of course he wasn't. It was memory. It's built on this great moment in the Aeneid when Aeneas goes down to the underworld in Virgil and his old friends and enemies come up to shout at him. But their voices turn into whispers because it's the underworld, because there are no voices there. And you know, it's just a poem of love and memory. It's called Love. Dark falls on this Midwestern town where we once lived when myths collided. Dusk has hidden the bridge in the river, which slides and deepens to become the water the hero crossed on his way to hell. Not far from here is our old apartment. We had a kitchen and an Amish table. We had a view, and we discovered there love had the feather and muscle of wings and had come to live with us, a brother of fire and air. We had two infant children, one of whom was touched by death in this town and spared. And when the hero was hailed by his comrades in hell, their mouths opened and their voices failed, and there is no knowing what they would have asked about a life they had shared and lost. I am your wife, it was years ago. Our child is healed, we love each other still. Across our day-to-day and ordinary distances, we speak plainly, we hear each other clearly, and yet I want to return to you on the bridge of the Iowa River as you were, with snow on the shoulders of your coat and a car passing with its headlights on. And I see you as a hero in a text, the image blazing and the edges gilded, and I long to cry out the epic question, my dear companion, will we ever live so intensely again? Will love come to us again and be so formidable at rest? It offered us ascension even to look at him. But the words are shadows and you cannot hear me. You walk away and I cannot follow. Now, the brief piece of prose I read there about the National Maternity Hospital, where my grandmother died, it is evocative to me for a couple of reasons. I teach at Stanford University, and I'm lucky enough to teach young poets there in a wonderful workshop, the Stegner Workshop. But, you know, if somebody said to me, well, was that your favorite job of all time? Well, it was one of them. But the other favorite job belongs to Dublin. And the National Maternity Hospital was established in 1894. And you can't miss it in the city of Dublin. I mean, it's right there in the middle of the city. And you really can't get up to Trinity College without going past the hospital. And it's a big red brick Victorian building. It is, in fact, the hospital in the Oxen of the Sun chapter in James Joyce's Ulysses. And I cannot tell you how little the hospital wants to remember that. So you're going to have to, you know, go a long way through the hospital before you see a plaque to James Joyce. It's not a complimentary chapter. And so they were established in 1894. And, you know, in 1994, it came to be their centenary. And they asked me to be their poet in residence for that centenary. And it was a very Irish job, no job description of any kind, you know. And so, you know, a lot of people in the city would say to me, you know, what are you doing at the National Maternity Hospital? You know, what is it, you know, you do? Do you, you know, spend time with the new mothers and the new babies? And, you know, of course, I spent not a minute with the new mothers and the new babies for this reason, that my own children were born in the National Maternity Hospital, and just the last thing I would have liked to have seen when they were born was the poet in residence. So, but they did give me a room, and I did connect to certain times there, and I wrote this poem in that year, and I always think very fondly of the hospital. This is called The Pomegranate, and indeed is about my first daughter. And really, again, is based on the beautiful myth of Ceres and Persephone. Ceres' child goes down to the underworld, is kidnapped, and she gets her back for half the year, which becomes the spring and summer, and the child stays down there for half the year, which is, you know, the winter and autumn. And the child could have come back completely, but if they didn't eat something, the child eats the pomegranate. The only legend I have ever loved is the story of a daughter lost in hell and found and rescued there. Love and blackmail are the gist of it, Ceres and Persephone the names. And the best thing about the legend is I can enter it anywhere and have. As a child in exile, in a city of fogs and strange consonants, I read it first. And at first, I was an exiled child in the crackling dusk of the underworld, the stars blighted. Later, I walked out in a summer twilight, searching for my daughter at bedtime. When she came running, I was ready to make any bargain to keep her. I carried her back past white beams and wasps and honey-scented buddleias, but I was Ceres then, and I knew winter was in store, for every leaf on every tree on that road was inescapable for each one we passed and for me. It is winter and the stars are hidden. I climb the stairs and stand where I can see my child asleep beside her teen magazines, her can of Coke, her plate of uncut fruit. The pomegranate, how did I forget it? She could have come home and been safe and ended the story and all our heartbroken searching. But she reached out a hand and plucked a pomegranate. She put out her hand and pulled down the French sand for apple and the noise of stone and the proof that even in the place of death, at the heart of legend, in the midst of rocks full of unshed tears, ready to be diamonds by the time the story was told, a child can be hungry. I could warn her there is still a chance. The rain is cold, the road is flint-colored, the suburb has cars and cable television. The veiled stars are above ground. It is another world. But what else can a mother give her daughter but such beautiful rifts in time? If I defer the grief, I will diminish the gift. The legend will be hers as well as mine. She will enter it as I have. She will wake up. She will hold the papery, flushed skin in her hand and to her lips, and I will say nothing. The idea of that past and that history troubled me probably most because when I grew up, my mother in many ways was and remains, you know, my great hero. And my mother came from a hard-pressed background in Ireland, you know, a background which was fortunately becoming rarer even then. Her mother did indeed die. The woman who died at 31 died in a fever ward in 1909, and she was her mother's fifth child, last child, and she was orphaned by that death. It was a poor family, and her father drowned in the Bay of Biscay. And, you know, I'm going to read a very brief piece of prose after this that develops this a little bit more. But my mother was very reluctant to talk about the past, and she was very reluctant to speak about the things that we think of as ordinary family anecdotes. She had very little time for it. But my grandfather at one point, he did drown in the Bay of Biscay, but before that he was a sea captain. He had one of his own ships that he sailed out of the Boyne. And, you know, I asked my mother about them, and she told me this just small, tiny thing, that, you know, wherever my grandfather's ship docked, her mother would go to meet it because she feared the women at the ports. So it wasn't a lot of family history, but it was something that, you know, stuck in my mind. This is a poem called Lava Cameo. A lava cameo is a brooch that was very common in Victorian times. There was great fashion for, you know, volcanic things, and it really was a face kind of cut in lava and cut in the material of destruction. And because of that, something, you know, about this poem was there for me to question: how much right do we have to go back to the past? How much right do we have to go back to the complicated place which was once the present of other people? And yet we long to go back there. We long to know who those people were since we came from them. And this poem's called Lava Cameo. I like this story, My grandfather was a sea captain. My grandmother always met him when his ship docked. She feared the women at the ports, except that it is not a story, more a rumor or a folk memory, something thrown out once in a random conversation, a hint merely. If I say woolen lace for her skirt and crepe for her blouse, in the neck of which is pinned a cameo carved out of black volcanic rock, and if I make her pace the cork docks, stopping to take down her parasol as a gust catches the silk tassels of it, then consider this. There is a way of making free with the past, a pastiche of what is real and what is not, which can only be justified if you think of it not as sculpture, but syntax, a structure extrinsic to meaning, which uncovers the inner secret of it. She will die at 31 in a fever ward. He will drown 9 years later in the Bay of Biscay. They will never even be sepia. And so I put down the gangplank now between the ship and the ground. In the story, late afternoon has become evening. They kiss once, their hands touch briefly. Please look at me, I want to say to her. Show me the obduracy of an art which can arrest profile in the flux of hell. Inscribe catastrophe. Now, my mother had, as I said, no time whatsoever for my interest in the past or history. And she really never spoke to me, except in these very chance remarks like you get in Love, a Cameo. She never, never spoke to me about it. And she lived really blessedly near us, as I said, was just a great hero of mine, and I greatly admired her. But time and again, I tried to get her to talk about her own past, and she never did. But one evening, you know, when my children were very small, I went down to visit her, and she lived very near us, and we were in conversation. And then suddenly, as if a door sprang open, she told me this totally bizarre story about her grandfather and my great-grandfather. And I was so taken aback by the story and, you know, so amazed. And I said to her, is that true? And she said, I don't know. So, but, you know, so the story comes with that warning attached to it, but nevertheless, you know, it represents that huge zone between the past and history, which is just unverifiable in any possible way. And but I love the story, and here it is. My grandmother came from a family of millers. Sometime after the famine, they left the small fishing town of Milford in Donegal. Hard-pressed as they were, they must still have missed the idiosyncrasy of their own place. The sight of Mulroy Bay in February light, the main street with its steep climb up the side of a hill. And they moved east and south to the town of Dundalk, and there the business failed. And they moved again to Leitrim, a harsh county where her father, my great-grandfather, was born. It was to him that legend clung. And the way I build the legend now is the way I heard it from my mother, out of rumor and fossil fact and half memory. He was a small man, compact and saturnine in the way of many Western Irish people. If he was anything like his son, who I met for a few hours years ago, he had eloquent and strained features and a fine profile and close-set and obstinate eyes. And there was something strained and pinched about it all, which kept it well away from beauty. He grew up in Leitrim, and sometime in his early manhood, I imagine the early 1870s, he fell in love with a local girl. I know so little about her or about him that I have to become the fictional interventionist here and say that she was, of course, winning and expressive and true to him, and that he loved her stubbornly. But there was an obstacle. She was a younger sister, and in the manner of fables and indeed of the Irish countryside. Her oldest sister was plain and deserving, and on no account to be slighted by having the younger girl marry first. So it went around. The parents insisted he should offer his suit to the older sister. They might have offered him inducements, but I doubt it. The inducements could only have been local custom and iron decorum. There were no dowries. These were poor people, reduced in circumstance by a difficult century, utterly vulnerable to the sickness of a heifer or a farthing's change in the price of wheat. They would have brought to bear on him the influence of local opinion and approval. He must marry the older girl, that was all. And he was implacable. He would be the younger one, and that was that. The younger girl retained her love for him, and he for her. Finally, now the story gets quicker, gets unsteady, fills with unknown passages of time and event. The impasse yielded, love triumphed, and the wedding day was set. I have no document or certificate for this. I do have my grandmother's marriage certificate, but not this one. In any case, the cold signatures of the witnesses and the sacristan could do no justice to the event. The wedding day came. It seems safe to imagine a small granite church in the middle of a townland and the weather, more than likely, gray and overcast. Maybe the turnout a bit more than usual because of the notoriety of the whole thing. The struggle of wills, all the gossip and curiosity incurred on that account. The bride came dressed in white, heavily veiled. The vows were taken and repeated and said by the bride and the groom. The priest pronounced them man and wife. And for a single moment, it must have seemed to him that some wound of ill luck and misadventure in his own life had undergone a miraculous healing. Then he lifted her veil. It was not the face he loved. Convention had prevailed. The family had smuggled in the older, plainer girl, and he was bound to her by iron convention and legality for the rest of his life. But they had 13 children, so... newer book is called Domestic Violence, and the title poem has that poem, and it registers not just the domestic tragedy, but also the fever chart in a country of the private and the public. In the 1970s, when violence fell on Ireland, we had certainly hoped that our differences would be our strengths, and they weren't. They divided people, and night after night that decade, we saw the worst things of all, the small funerals, you know, day after day after day on television, small funerals from Irish people killing Irish people, the nightmare of any country. You know, we lived at that time in a house with two small children. When I went back in this poem, you know, I wanted to go back to that moment when you live in a time of violence and when the private life seems to be a shelter from it. But of course it's not. You know, those things are bound together by terrible and strong bonds, domestic violence. It was winter, lunar, wet. At dusk, pewter seedlings became moonlight orphans. Pleased to meet you, meet to please you, said the butcher's sign in the window in the village. Everything changed the year that we got married, and after that, we moved out to the suburbs. How young we were, how ignorant, how ready to think the only history was our own. And there was a couple who quarreled into the night, their voices high and sharp. Nothing is ever entirely right in the lives of those who love each other. And in that season, suddenly, our island broke out its old sores for all to see. We saw them too. We stood there wondering how the salt horizons and the Dublin hills and the rivers, Table Mountains, Viking marshes we thought we knew had been made to shiver into our ancient 12 by 15 television, which gave them back as gray and grayer tears and killings, 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 then moonlight-colored funerals. Nothing we said, not then, not later, fathomed what it is wrong in the lives of those who hate each other. And if the provenance of memory is only that, remember, not a tone. And if I can be safe in the weak spring light in that kitchen, then why is there another kitchen? Spring light always darkening in it, and a woman whispering to a man over and over, what else could we have done? We failed our moment, or our moment failed us. The times were grand in size, and we were small. Why do I write that when I don't believe it? We lived our lives, were happy, stayed as one. Children were born and raised here and are gone, including ours. As for that couple, did we ever find out who they were, and did we want to? I think we knew. I think we always knew. I want to read a poem which I wrote, really. It's called An Elegy for My Mother, in which she scarcely appears. And it's, you know, really about the time of her death. I remembered, you know, my mother had, as I think a lot of people had, a great love for the domestic implements of a kitchen. You know, the wooden clothes horse that, you know, you stood against the fire and you put tea cloths on. You know, the way that you had a singing kettle, not an electric kettle. And all of those things disappeared. They just went. And we have no environmentalism for lost objects. We don't care about them. We replace them. And in some ways, you know, it was those beautiful, dumb things that I thought about when my mother died. And she, in some ways, had been their champion. And I wanted to make a note of that. An Elegy for My Mother, in which she scarcely appears. I knew we had to grieve for the animals a long time ago. Weep for them, pity them. I knew it was our strange human duty to write their elegies after we arranged their demise. I was young then and able for the paradox. I am older now and ready with the question. What happened to them all? I mean to those old dumb implements which have no eyes to plead with us, like theirs, no claim to make on us, like theirs. I mean, there was a singing kettle. I want to know why no one tagged its neck or ringed the tin bass of its extinct design or crouched to hear its rising shriek in winter or wrote it down with the birds in their blue sleeves of air, torn away with the trees that sheltered them. And there were brass fire dogs, which lay out all evening on the grate and in the heat thrown at them by the last of the peat fire. But no one noted down their history or put them in the old packs under slate-blue moonlight. There was a wooden clothes horse, absolutely steady, without sinews, with no mane and no meadows to canter in, carrying, instead of landlords or Irish monks, rinsed tea cloths, but still, I would have thought, worth adding to the catalogue of what we need, what we always need, as is my mother, on this Dublin evening of fog crystals and frost, as she reaches out to test one corner of a tea cloth for dryness, as the pre-war Irish twilight closes in and down on the room and the curtains are drawn. And here am I, not even born, and already a conservationist, with nothing to assist me but the last and most fabulous of beasts, language, language, which knows as I do that it's too late to record the loss of these things, but does so anyway and anxiously, in case it shares their fate. I want to finish with a poem here called The Emigrant Irish, which, you know, I wrote a long time ago. But, you know, now I think of those things and indeed about the Irish more than I once did. And Ireland has been transformed in the last 10 or 15 years. It's a very prosperous modern state. We once were a people whose people left our shores and largely came to your shores. And, you know, I lived in the United States as a child in New York for a few years, 3 years when I was 12. And my mother took great care to point out to me the places, the wharfs where the Irish had come in from those boats. And, you know, at one point in Ireland, as we were on our way to become a modern state, it struck me that we might forget those people or want to forget those people who left us and went somewhere else. And yet those people, who are some of the best of us, you know, were themselves a great instruction to memory and to example. I didn't think we could or should forget them. And, you know, the poem really was started by a comment my mother-in-law made to me very briefly, that when electricity came west of the Shannon, which, you know, and they finally got electric light there, all the people took their beautiful oil lamps and threw them out and, you know, suddenly disowned that loyal past. So this is the emigrant Irish. Like oil lamps, we put them out the back of our houses, of our minds. We had lights better than, newer than, and then a time came, this time, and now we need them. Their dread makeshift example. They would have thrived on our necessities. What they survived, we could not even live. By their lights now, it is time to imagine how they stood there, what they stood with, that their possessions may become our power. Cardboard, iron, their hardships parceled in them, patience, fortitude, long suffering in the bruise-colored dusk of the new world, and all the old songs and nothing to lose. Thank you very much. So I'm going to take questions. I'm to be a kind of one-person Delphic oracle here, I think, and sort of, You know, I'm going to start with one question, which is a one-liner, which said, Murphy's Stout or Guinness, ? All right. I'll defer to the question. I have to apologize to the questioner. I belong to an extremely small and unadvertised minority in Ireland. I've never taken a drink in my life. It's, well, maybe, but, you know, it's, as I said, it's not a visible Irish constituency. So I really, you know, I really don't know. But, you know, I know that, you know, probably when I was young, you know, Guinness was always called the wine of the country. Not that Murphy's isn't a great stout, but I think that, you know, they used to say, which I'm sure is nonsense, that Guinness was made out of Liffey water and all the rationalizations the Dubliners had for drinking it. So probably being a Dubliner, I'm sure I'd say Guinness, you know, but... What is the greatest challenge facing women today? How has... it's a nice small question here. That, how has the world changed for women since you started writing? Well, I mean, that's a very subjective thing. I mean, I think I would have said this today. This is a long narrative in Ireland, especially. Ireland had, when I was very young, very inequitable and notorious legislation against women. I mean, women could not sit on a jury in Ireland when I was 20, unless they held property, and only 2% of Irish women held property. Women in Ireland were fired from the public service the day they got married. All of that went to the European Court and was changed. But I do remember at 20 going home, you know, I joined the women's movement, and saying to my father, why can women not sit on juries? And he was with my mother, who my mother was leaned very much towards women. And he said, why do women want to sit on juries? You know? So my mother said, don't worry about your father's answer, she said. I was in Paris, and a man said to me, women are too beautiful to vote. So that was the French view of it. Anyway, we had to come a long journey we had to come a long journey in Ireland to have the equality the United States had for a very long time, and indeed the British had after the commissions of the 20s and 30s. And I think there are understandable reasons for that. We were a small country. We had a struggle, but if we were against colony, then we couldn't colonize part of our own people. It was not logical. So I think that the greatest challenge for women, strangely enough, having said all that, the greatest challenge for women today in Ireland, and I shouldn't speak about anywhere else, and I certainly should not speak about the United States, is the challenge of for young men and young women in Ireland. Ireland has become a prosperous country in European terms. And, one of the things we most had is Yeats's great phrase that we were a community bound together by imaginative possessions, and we were, and that what we had was not visible in terms of those things, but we had those great things, the story and the language and the people, and beyond price. If we lose those things, we will really not have anything else. Becoming a rich city is not really a great idea for Ireland. There are plenty of others that are going to be better, richer, bigger. But being Irish as we were, and holding on to a past that we never disowned, even though those people were defenseless, they were our own people. If we lose that, then we will lose exactly what made us Irish. And so the young men, I think, and women in Ireland have to recognize that in this tide of prosperity, we run a risk of losing who we, not just what we have, but who we are. And that would be the challenge of that generation, I think, and a very different challenge from when we were young. This is interesting. It says, is it essential for a young poet to master poetic forms? No, is the short answer to that. No, it's not. I mean, it's essential for a young poet to find their voice. Maybe if you know poetic forms, you might feel you have some choices along the way, but that's not certain that you won't have them, even if you don't. So some people do very well. I learned a lot of poetic forms when I was younger. Maybe they gave me a feeling of a bit more choice, but I ended up probably the same as I would have been. So I don't think anything is necessary for a young poet to learn, as a piece of knowledge, but it is essential for a young poet to find their voice. That part they have to do. How they find that's different in every culture. There's in every culture has a distance that is mappable between writing poems and being a poet. And people have to find that for themselves in every culture. And I think maybe, you're not going to harm yourself if you learn how to write a villanelle, but I don't think you're going to solve all your problems either. All right, many children and teenagers hide their differences when they are discriminated against or teased. Why do you think encountering anti-Irish sentiment increased your identification with your heritage? Well, it's an interesting question. I went to school in England when I was 6 years of age. I left Ireland, my father went to England too. He was a diplomat. And it was the early 50s, time of very strong anti-Irish sentiment in the City of London. And of course, I hated that as a child, although you never know how to identify it. And the very first day we went to this school, my sisters and myself, and we didn't know much about Britain, and knew enough, I think. But you know, the very first day, my sister was asked in class, you know, why is Henry VIII called the Eighth? And she said, because he had eight wives. And, you know, it's a very unpopular answer, you know, with the teacher. And you know, they didn't like Ireland. I mean, if I went back now, I think I would take a compassionate view of that. But I didn't at the time. And I do remember I used the word amant, which is, you know, the Irish usage. The English say I'm not, and the Irish say I amant. And I said, you know, I am going to do that. And the teacher said to me, you're not in Ireland now. And so I don't know that I would take that to the interesting second part of the question and say, you know, did it make me identify with my heritage? I probably didn't know my heritage, but it certainly made me disidentify with the British, which is one part of it. Which do you feel is most prevalent in your poetry, lyric or narrative? There's a very nice paragraph of William Yeats's essays in which he, you know, makes a difference between the British and Irish poetic tradition. There's a beautiful sentence about British poetry and says, you know, it is a narrative and contemplative poetry, you know, that remembers the Thames Valley, and maybe the Irish are more lyric and more in crisis time. I know that generalizations of poetries are very difficult, and there's been a very rich traffic between British and Irish poetry on that, but probably I think of myself more as a straightforward lyric poet than I would think of myself as a narrative poet. So the next question. Recently, I presented your poem, The Death of Reason, to my students and asked them to compare it to Yeats's The Second Coming. In what ways do you see yourself continuing the poetic tradition established by Yeats, and in what ways do you feel you've departed from it or changed it? Well, you know, Yeats is by a long way my favorite poet, and Yeats was the person who in many ways put Irish poetry, set it forward on its path, and, you know, wrote this great poetry of increasing power even when he felt powerless. But he was a high formalist, and I do think that Irish poetry has become a little bit more hybrid and more conversational and more negotiating with slightly different and more open form from him. But he remains the great spirit, the great example, but not always a popular poet in the city, because he was an Anglo-Irish poet. The Irish are not strong on making their writers like that. But I do remember my father, as I said, was a civil servant. He worked in Ivy House, which looks directly out on Stephen's Green. And William Yeats was well known, you know, in the 30s, to always go every day and walk in Stephen's Green. And my father said to me, you know, I used to see Yeats, he said, walking in Stephen's Green all the time. I said, what was that like? He said, one of his feet turned in. That was a Dublin response on William Yeats. Yes. One more. There is one more. Please explain further what it means to make free with the past rather than through sculpture. Why do you write so few dramatic monologues? I leave maybe that one off. But I think when you go to the past and you reconstruct it, maybe you do it at risk, you do it in language, you do it in syntax. Thank you very much.
That was Evan Bolin from a Literary Arts Poetry Downtown event in 2008. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project, a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Hahn, on a mission to fuel your big ideas. More on colehahn.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. The show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another episode of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.